The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition. So a little change up today. It's not going to be Jim and Chris on the show today. It's going to be Jake and Chris. So I'm Chris. I'll get Jake in here in just a moment. But Jim, as he mentioned on previous shows, is preparing to head off back to Ohio for a while, and he's frantically packing up to make that happen. He's either leaving later today or tomorrow. And so he handed it off to us. So what he asked us to do, and we're going to do our best to fulfill his wishes, is talk a little bit about our process and our approach, kind of triggered by several listener questions. So this is going to feel a little bit like a Q&A show, but it is focused really on our philosophy and approach. And so we're going to classify it as an EDU show today because we're kind of focused on one particular topic. So anyway, that's where we're at. Jake, thanks for joining me this afternoon to record this for everybody.
No problem. Thanks, Chris. Thanks for allowing me to join. And it's been a minute, but glad to be back in the podcast seat here. Looking forward to sharing more about our approach. And after all, I mean, you know, people are clamming for more Q&A shows. So I don't think people will mind if we tackle a few process-related questions that listeners have sent in today.
Yeah. Before we get into those, weren't you recently on vacation?
Oh, yes. Yes, yeah. Indeed, I was. I spent some time.
Yeah, I haven't heard yet, so you can share with me and our listeners kind of what you did.
Yeah, so I was over in the country of Ireland, the island of Ireland, for just about 9 or 10 days recently. Kind of split up into two trips. First week was golfing with some friends, and it's a group I've gone with for many, many years now. And we don't often go international. This is only our second trip in probably 10 years, but this was one that had been on we've been planning for about a year and a half. And so it was really, really fun to play some of the prestigious Lynx courses in the southwest of Ireland. So that was great. And then towards the end of that, my wife Katie flew over, and then we spent another 5 days just doing touristy stuff. Yeah, we had a great time, and the weather cooperated for the most part. And it was great. Yeah, but I've been back almost a week now, so jet lag's done, and I'm feeling like myself again.
Nice. What you said? The weather generally cooperated. What is the weather like in Ireland at this time of year?
Oh, windy and be fairly rainy. It was much cooler. I mean, you know, especially being closer to the coast, I think, I don't think it ever got out of the 60s. And then, you know, in the 50s overnight is really, really pleasant from the hot, humid Midwest summer. So I was loving it.
Yeah. I haven't been to Ireland, but it strikes me as windy and a fair amount of rain to keep it so green
and
lush.
Exactly. Well, it was interesting too, because there was that, I forget the name of it, but there was that hurricane that kind of moved up the east coast of the U.S. and then shot towards Ireland that we got the first couple of days. Some of the remnants of that. And then there was another, it wasn't a hurricane, but kind of a some sort of oceanic disturbance that created some pretty gnarly winds and a couple of days of rain. I guess it would have been the weekend of our Labor Day. We had a couple of days where we were pretty, it was pretty soggy, but you know, nothing a pint of Guinness and a cup of soup can't cure.
How was the international travel aspect of it in this day and age? I haven't flown internationally for a while.
It was really easy. This is a tip for those, I guess. I was able to fly direct from O'Hare here in Chicago to Shannon. So Dublin's the airport, you know, obviously the biggest international airport in Ireland, but Shannon has a few international flights from the U.S., typically from the East Coast and Chicago. And man, if you can fly direct, it makes it so much easier. And the airport's fairly small, you know, going through customs took no time at all. It was really a breeze.
That's good. Well, excellent. Yeah. Glad to have you back and happy that you're on the show today. Let me hop over to the emails that Jim sent over. And we're going to start with one that is a question that comes up regularly as part of our approach. And it comes up regularly because it is, I agree and admit that it is somewhat confusing and not necessarily common sense, I guess, or as simple as a lot of people might assume it to be. And it's surrounding how we deal with income taxes in our concept of the minimum dignity floor. So that's what we're going to get into first. Let me pull up the email. It's nice. It's pretty darn short here. And actually, there is a state hint I'll give to everybody here. Jake and I have seen it because Jim forwarded us the email. So I think most people would have gotten this, the state hint. This state has a city which has hosted the Summer Olympics twice. That, of course, is Los Angeles. So that one, a good hint, but I think that one, most people paying attention would have gotten that one. But here's their question. He says, hi, Jim, Chris, and the two J's. So one of the J's is with me today. Question about MDF, so minimum dignity floor categories. In addition to food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, shouldn't there be a sixth category, taxes? Taxes would be for income taxes. In my household, our largest expense is by far income taxes, federal and state. Thank you. They signed their name, but we'll call them George or Georgette. And this is a common question because when people think of our minimum dignity floor expenses, which they rightfully listed as the categories of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, they liken those to what a lot of people call required expenses or mandatory expenses or non-discretionary expenses in the industry. And so it is natural for them to think, you know what? Income taxes are required to be paid. So shouldn't income taxes be part of this thing we call the minimum dignity floor? Well, close. The interpretation is a little bit off. Our concept of the minimum dignity floor, let me back up and explain the purpose of identifying either for yourselves, if you're doing this as a do-it-yourself exercise or working with us or someone else who's kind of deploying our approach. The purpose of determining the minimum dignity floor expense group, so the level of the minimum dignity floor, is to help determine how much secure income we believe is appropriate for you to have throughout your life in order to protect those key expense categories of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. And so if you always keep in mind that the minimum dignity floor, establishing that for yourself, is not about determining your total mandatory expenses for a particular year. It is to really instead give us a benchmark to compare against to determine if you have enough secure income, which comes in the form of Social Security pensions and income annuities if one needs them, in order to create this foundation or floor or safety net in your retirement plan, such that you can, you know, the goal is to have you be comfortable enough with the plan, knowing that secure income, which you cannot outlive, will be sufficient in size to cover those most critical expenses that are going to be with you for as long as you live as well. So income taxes, if they're owed, if you owe your taxes, it's required that you pay them. Totally admit that. However, not all income taxes are created equal. When we look at proper levels of secure income, the obvious expenses that we need to cover are the food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, at least by our definition of what has been, you know, evolved to be known as the minimum dignity floor expenses. Absolutely, the secure income has to cover that. But then the question becomes, if I've run out of assets and therefore kind of hitting my safety net where I'm just living on my minimum dignity floor expenses and I'm not doing anything discretionary, travel, that sort of thing, which is the type of thing that would stop if someone ran out of assets, how much income, secure income specifically, do I need to not only cover those five categories of expenses, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, but also cover any taxes, income taxes, associated with the secure income itself? And that's where we have to look at things very closely, because if someone has a lot of assets still, those assets, especially if they're inside of an IRA or a 401k, what we call always taxable, there are inherent income taxes attached to that asset, which if you take the income out of those accounts, you have to pay the income tax. I'm not disputing that. But remember what we were trying to determine. We're trying to determine first, before we're looking at the big picture, determining first, do you have enough secure income to cover the minimum dignity floor if you run out of assets? That last part is critical. So if we focus on that, if you run out of assets, we have to then admit a bunch of the taxes that seem to be there now when the assets are intact would not be there and would not need to be covered by secure income if you truly had run out of assets and were living solely on secure income. So only a portion of the total tax bill really needs to be considered part of what we call your minimum dignity floor. Because remember, the purpose is to the minimum dignity floor to define the appropriate amount of secure income. So this one, a lot of people have to kind of think through multiple times, maybe even listen to my description multiple times for it to click, because it just kind of goes against what your gut is telling you. That income taxes are required. You must pay them. So if we want to make sure we have enough secure income to cover the required expenses, we've got to cover the taxes. But if you take that view, essentially what you've done, that view would be very popular with annuity salespeople. Because what that's going to do, imagine at RMD age, where a lot of you will see a lot of income taxes being owed. If I propose that you cover not only the food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, but also all the income taxes on the RMDs and other distributions you might be making later in life, particularly after RMD age, I'm essentially overselling you annuity income, secure income. I'm telling you, you need lifetime income to cover these taxes, even though those taxes are connected to an asset, which the asset itself could satisfy the taxes. But we're going to ignore that, and we're going to make sure we have enough secure income to cover those taxes in full. Well, that's going to really increase, for most people, the amount of secure income needed post-RMD age, which leads to then a suggestion that you need much more annuity income than what we would propose you have. That's the difference. That's the critical part, is you've got to always remember why we're establishing the minimum dignity floor. It isn't about telling you in any given year the total amount of required expenses you have. Because in any given year, you are required to pay the income taxes that year. Not disputing that. The minimum dignity floor for us is a tool to help determine the appropriate amount of secure income. That's the focus. That's the emphasis here. And if you look at it that way, we don't need to cover all of the taxes, income taxes, with secure income, because any taxes associated with an asset, an account like a 401k IRA, would be able to be satisfied by the asset itself. They don't need to rely on the secure income. And when that asset depletes, if it does, those taxes go away too. So in the case you don't have the asset, you also don't need the secure income to cover the income taxes for that portion, because those income taxes no longer exist. There are income taxes, though, associated with your Social Security pension and annuity income, some higher, some lower, depending on the nature of those three things. So I admit some income taxes need to be considered when establishing your appropriate size of secure income for the long haul, but not all the taxes. So hopefully that, you know, maybe Jake, you can tell me, I'm sure you, I mean, you've heard me describe this numerous times. It is confusing, and I totally get that. So I'm not shocked we have this question again. Even if this person has heard it described before, takes a few times and your brain might need to marinate in it a little bit and think about it. And you might even disagree, right? Some people, you know, just take the approach that we're going to fund all of the taxes with the secure income. I think that's being overly aggressive in how much secure income you need. But you can certainly, I mean, this is just our approach, what I've just described. Right. Other people can do it differently. But Jake, did you pick up on any glaring issues with what I described, or ways you can, you know, maybe fine tune it or clarify it for somebody who didn't quite get it even with this last description?
Not really. I mean, I think I've heard you describe this many times, and I've described this to clients as well. But I think you hit on the main point, and I'll emphasize it again, is again, this is our approach. You know, how much secure income do you need to protect your minimum dignity floor? That big if you were to run out of assets. Because as you're projecting things out, you're going to, you know, and I witness this when I'm doing this with clients and presenting a retirement plan, is, you know, we do isolate the projected taxes when we're looking at secure income and minimum dignity floor expenses. But that's where we acknowledge that a lot of those taxes, like Chris said, are a result of assets. So think about this. If you've got, you know, say, I'll just make up a number, $1 million in a taxable brokerage account, or what we call maybe taxable, that's probably conservatively spitting out, you know, maybe $20,000 a year of income that will have some taxes due, again, depending on the tax treatment of the income coming out of it. Imagine if that goes away, or you spend through all that. And I know these are scenarios where you're like, well, I wouldn't spend through all that. But the purpose of what we're trying to isolate here is ensuring that we, especially for that post-delay minimum dignity floor position, is what is that amount of your portfolio that you need to set aside in order to give your older selves the option to purchase additional secure income? If we were to account for all of the projected taxes based on not only that brokerage account, but maybe you've got another couple million and always taxable, so there's going to be some RMDs, again, as a result of having that asset is driving those taxes. If we were to suggest an amount to reserve to cover not only the minimum dignity floor expenses, but also the estimated taxes, as Chris said, we would be likely, if not always, overestimating the amount of money that you would be reserving for that position, and thus limiting probably the total amount that would go towards your fund number. So we are intentional in doing that. And like Chris said, not everybody does it that way, and you don't have to. That's just the way that we do it. And so when you are doing these projections or looking at it yourselves, just keep that in mind, that we're looking at acknowledging there's taxes due, but we want to make sure that we are only preserving assets to generate secure income in order to pay the tax as if that is what you had. You didn't have all of these other assets that would be generating taxes on their own. Because like Chris said, if you have those assets, well, you have the tax, you can pay the taxes from those assets.
Right. Right. And the only other thing I'll add is that each scenario is a little different. It depends on the mixture of accounts you have and what income taxes are being thrown off by those accounts, maybe out of your control due to RMDs or what have you, versus other types of income you might have. The mixture is unique to each person. But anecdotally, I will say that usually when we examine it, if we look at that period from RMD age and older, kind of that, it's not technically quite the end of the delay period, but it's close, right? Because the delay period, as we describe it, usually ends at 70 for most people when they turn on their Social Security. That's the latest they might consider doing that. An RMD age, you know, 73 to 75, but it's when the RMDs kick in, we usually see, for a lot of people who were active savers, we'll call them, and built up a nice nest egg, that their tax bill really spikes at that point. So their overall taxes on everything, to include the taxes on the RMDs that might be coming out, I usually see and gauge that somewhere between a third to one half of the overall taxes do probably need to be planned to be covered by the secure income. Because, like I said, if your minimum dignity floor is fairly large, if you're in a fairly high cost state, it can be fairly large, and you might have, you know, your Social Security pension and or annuity income coming in, those income amounts might be, you know, fairly large to cover the minimum dignity floor. We might be talking, by the time someone's in their early 70s, $120,000 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so if you've got $120,000 of income coming in, or maybe all your resources are in always taxable, and then you have Social Security, you're going to have some taxes, right? You're going to have some taxes at that point. And so just kind of the nature of your circumstances, the size of your food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, how your resources that you're going to utilize maybe to generate secure income, is your secure income going to be an annuitization of an IRA, which would be totally taxable? Is it going to be annuitization of the maybe taxable, which would only be partially taxable? Or maybe even annuitization of Roth, which would be tax-free. Obviously, if that's the case, if you've annuitized a Roth as part of your secure income mixture, your taxes, if you were to run out of assets, would be minuscule. I don't need to cover hardly any taxes, because if that's truly your circumstances, you've got this Roth annuity plus Social Security, your tax bill is going to be tiny, if not zero. Kind of depends, you know, on your size of your Social Security, et cetera. But you get the points. Some people, due to the nature of their resources, have a lot more embedded taxes than others. So there's not just one rule where we say you do it this way. You really have to dig into it and look at the whole picture and then do what's reasonable. And I think it's unreasonable to cover all the taxes that you might be projecting throughout your life with secure income. Because again, a lot of those income taxes are not permanent. They're only there if the asset exists. And if you're lucky enough to have assets exist all the way through to your death and there's still a bunch of assets left over, those assets were self-supporting of the taxes related to those assets. You don't need the secure income to cover it. If you ran out of those assets, the taxes go away. So in either case, you didn't need to cover all the taxes with the secure income. So just wanted to kind of add that maybe a quarter to a half would probably be the better range of the projected overall taxes. The rest is considered, is likely to be taxes associated with assets and distributions from assets, whether they're forced as an RMD or just taken out voluntarily to live on, that the asset's there so it can be supported by the asset itself, the income taxes associated with it. So I hope that helps this listener and others who might. And I'm sure there's a bunch of you out there, especially if you haven't been a longtime listener and heard us talk about that in great detail in the past, been thinking the same thing. Why do they never mention income taxes as part of the food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare group that we call the minimum dignity floor. It's kind of, and the minimum dignity floor really should be labeled those five and possibly some of the taxes, I guess.
Exactly.
Should be kind of like the A, E, I, O, U, and sometimes Y. It's food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, and likely some taxes, but not all.
It's exactly.
Kind of how we should probably redefine that. So anyway, the next question is also kind of about our approach and getting our thoughts on how we deal with certain things. And this is related to doing Roth conversions and being sensitive, if you will, to IRMA, the income-related monthly adjustment amount. So pretty short email, but it says, you addressed this to Jim, sent it to Jim. Thanks for the show and your great team. I'm a longtime listener. I listened to Chris and the two J's on show number 2530. There was an interesting Q&A discussion about minimizing IRMA and implications for Roth conversions. This gave me a thought and this question. Is there a strategy for using Roth funds to supplement my pension supporting our, and they labeled it in all caps, FUTHH, which is food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, what we call your minimum dignity floor. So is there a strategy for using Roth funds to supplement my pension supporting our minimum dignity floor and fund number versus using IRA dividend funds, which I'm not sure the emphasis on dividend funds, because in your IRA, just because you have investments generating dividends, it doesn't matter the nature of what's in the IRA. As it comes out of the IRA, it's all going to be ordinary income. So he obviously means taking distributions from his IRA to supplement his pension and his fund spending. He continues, I would then increase my Roth conversions to 100K per year, plus, given my lower AGI, my future RMDs are onerous. So he's considering, instead of taking distributions from his IRA, instead taking it from his Roth. He's got Roth dollars built up. But then because he wouldn't have the AGI, adjusted gross income, from doing the IRA distributions he was previously doing, he'd be taking from Roth, which is not taxable, not generating AGI. He'd turn around then and do a Roth conversion of 100 plus per year. And then he gets into a few details, nothing particularly critical here, other than he and his wife were in his late 60s, 66 and 67, waiting to 70 to turn on Social Security, have an $80,000 pension, have dividends being generated inside their IRA of about $65,000, which it sounds like they've been taking out, doing Roth conversions of about $50,000 a year. But here's where the connection to those onerous RMDs comes in. Currently has about $3.1 million of IRA money, $3.4 million of Roth, so he's been obviously dedicated to building Roth, either through contributions over time or conversions, and another couple million in a brokerage account, which is probably generating some AGI in the form of dividends and interest and cap gains if it's actively being traded. No kids, so their tax priority is the two. So I guess initially, Jake,
yeah,
would stopping IRA distributions, but then turning around doing a Roth conversion, what would that look like?
I mean, and this is kind of a good news, bad news. It's not going to make a heck of a lot of difference because, as you mentioned previously, if you're and maybe he's misunderstanding the taxation on dividends in the IRA, potentially, maybe thinking about it more like a brokerage account. But yeah, if you're, my assumption based on reading this is that he's potentially leaving the corpus or the principal of his IRA alone and just taking out the investment income as a distribution from the IRA. But as Chris already mentioned, that's taxed as ordinary income, no matter what comes out of the IRA. And then same thing if you're doing a Roth conversion. You're still realizing income at the time you're doing the conversion in the year that you do it. And the amount that you convert from your traditional IRA to your Roth IRA is taxable ordinary income for that year. So whether you take out $60,000 or $100,000 of investment income from the IRA, or you do a $100,000 Roth conversion, from a tax perspective, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other.
It's a wash. Yeah. So if you replace distributions with conversion on your income tax return, it's a wash. You end up in the exact same place. So if he's trying to reduce his AGI to avoid IRMA, that's not going to work. Now, if he did the first part and not the second part, it would, but he might regret it. And what I mean by that is, if he were to switch to taking Roth distributions for his spending needs rather than IRA distributions, which he indicates he's doing now, that would lead to lower AGI, lower taxes, and because IRMA is related to AGI, maybe drop him out of, or at least to a lower IRMA bracket. But he mentioned his RMDs are already looking to be onerous when he gets there in just a few years, in about 6-7 years when he gets to 73, because he's got about $3.1 million in an IRA right now. And if he stops taking money out of that, hopefully it's invested to have a chance to grow, so it'll be even bigger than 3.1. RMDs are going to be pretty substantial from that at the time. So he will have saved some IRMA today and some income taxes today. But his fear, he obviously is nervous about it, because he pointed out and used the word onerous. That's kind of a scary term.
Negative connotation.
Right? Exactly. So he's clearly worried about those. That act of doing what I just described would make the RMD issue worse. Would make the RMD issue worse. Now, does that mean it's a bad idea? Not necessarily. It kind of all depends. What we don't have, we didn't put all this into any kind of projection software, what have you, but if he did some projections, either in a spreadsheet or through a variety of software programs that are available, he could play around with it and look at the way I would probably attack this is I would look at the potential reductions of IRMA in a trade-off for the potential increase in the effective tax rate on those RMDs and other distributions he'd be taking later on.
Yeah.
And see which one. I'm predicting that it's going to be kind of a wash, if you will, and maybe not as, the good news is that there might not be an obvious strategy that he is compelled to follow, because going left or going right isn't tremendously different. That'll be the frustrating thing, because sometimes you just have what you have and you have some embedded taxes, which I would put IRMA in the tax category. It's a penalty for having too much income, which they call it an increase in your Medicare premiums, but because it's tied to your income on your tax return, I call it another tax, that sometimes you just have enough resources. He's sitting on $6.5 million between his IRA and his Roth, another $2.3 million. So, almost $9 million. And to think that at that level, you're going to be able to simultaneously control your RMDs to keep your income taxes reasonable and avoid IRMA, that's a lofty goal, probably not going to happen very well. But I think it's worth, if you don't mind putting in some effort into it and looking at it, doing some analysis on it, you could kind of look at those two things. What could I save potentially in IRMA if I controlled my income using my Roth? He pointed out he doesn't have kids, so he doesn't necessarily want to save the Roth to be able to go tax efficiently to kids. So using it isn't a bad idea. But then make a reasonable projection about what size your IRA might hit when you get RMD age, and project then what kind of bracket it's going to push you into in not only income tax bracket after RMDs kick in, but much higher IRMA. You might really like your IRMA situation using Roth between now and 73, but then you realize I'm in an unattractive marginal tax bracket, and I've now pushed myself into an even worse Irma situation for the rest of my life. I enjoyed some relief for 6 years, but then I've got maybe another 20 years of real pain and suffering. And you could even model through some simulations, what if you ripped off the Band-Aid and did some big conversions? Maybe, you know, saying, hey, we're just going to blow the top off of the Irma brackets for a year or two, try to get as much of this IRA converted before RMD age. And because Irma is applied yearly, even if you, I mean, if you, you know, just really, I call it ripping the Band-Aid off, paid a fair amount of taxes and Irma for a year or two, that might sometimes, I'm saying might, provide you with long-term lifetime relief in both taxes and Irma. Yeah. And so that's another one where you'd look at what's the cost of me tearing off the Band-Aid and doing 2 to 3 years of really heavy conversions that I might otherwise never have considered. Let's do it several hundred thousand dollars a year. See what that looks like. Yes, it's going to immediately be a fairly heavy tax and Irma cost, but those are things you can calculate. But then look, let's see how my tax and Irma situation then is relieved for the next X number of years and see maybe how long it would take me to recover the cost of ripping off the Band-Aid. And if that isn't too far down the road, maybe that's a reasonable thing to consider. Isn't something you can figure out by gut or knee jerk or just eyeballing it or estimating it? I think you really need to sit down and crunch some numbers on this if you want to get into it, either yourself or somebody else who will kind of geek out on this and really dive into it. But it's possible there could be a strategy you might reveal, but it's, you're just also in a situation where you have a lot of resources and therefore you're in a position where taxes and fees are going to be part of your life.
Yeah. I would say this is a absolutely wonderful problem to have.
True.
Listener, mm-hmm. I would say, yes, I agree with Chris. Honestly, if you're really worried about kind of the overall tax burden, I can, again, not having run this through anything, I can almost bet the answer would be the last thing Chris said, which is 2 or 3 years of some pretty large conversions. And then, you know, you're getting your IRA and subsequent RMDs to a manageable level that then you can, you know, spend from Roth, which isn't going to have a tax impact, but I wouldn't waste a bunch of time worrying about it. I'd say just get to know Irma, embrace it. It's, you know, kind of a tax that comes with being a lifelong accumulator of assets. So I think, you know, your challenge now is figure out what do you want to do with these assets? And if you're paying a few thousand dollars a year in extra Irma, I mean, oh, well, you know, I'd say focus more on what you're going to do to enjoy your retirement and worry less about, you know, a few thousand dollars here or there. That's my contrarian take here.
Yeah. It might be a few other things you could look at if you're trying to control your Irma. Whenever someone has a brokerage account of size, like they have 2.3 million, having that invested in a tax efficient manner, so it's not throwing off a bunch of taxable income each year out of your control, could help you. And so 2.3 million, it could easily be, you know, without attention being paid in this area, could be throwing off $50,000 to $70,000 of taxable income, whether you're taking it out of there or not. It's generating AGI that you're going to be reporting on your tax return, and it's going to be considered for Irma determinations. Maybe reallocating in a much more tax efficient manner, so it's not generating all of that uncontrolled, you know, pushing out income onto your tax return. Could help a little bit too. So that's another area that could take some attention to maybe marginally improve their situation. So just some thoughts
good
on
question.
That. So yeah.
Good problem to have.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. The next one here. Let's see here. So dear Jim and Chris and the gang. So you're part of the gang today, Jake.
Thank you.
Thanks for all you're doing. I've listened to the podcast for years. Up till now, I've been thinking that I need to have CDs or something very secure set aside to cover the expenses during my 5-year delay period. I'm 65 and have been building up this reserve, but I've been tinkering with the plan and I'm wondering about using a, quote, very safe withdrawal rate, unquote, of 3% during the, quote, delay period, that time between retiring and turning on Social Security. Couldn't I take a blended approach and rely on CDs and, say, a 3% withdrawal rate during the delay period? In theory, it should not affect the principal if, and he says big if, market conditions remain relatively stable. Regardless of the details here, generally speaking, shouldn't I be able to take 2 to 3% from the portfolio now and be okay going forward? What say you and or the team? So why don't you go first on this, Jake?
Sure.
And then I'll kind of add my thoughts. I've got some immediate thoughts, but I'll
we'll
take turns here and you can go first.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to tackle this for this listener. I think the big thing would depend on what's the size of the overall portfolio. You know, because if it's a $10 million portfolio, then yes, taking, you know, 2 to 3% to cover any sort of delay period needs is not going to have a material difference on what's going on, even if there is large market volatility. But we'll assume it's not quite that large for the sake of argument here. And the reason that, you know, that we talked before and, maybe a reason that you're keeping these known dollars that you need for this defined period of time that does have an end is because if you've gone through the exercise of figuring out what a portion of your delay period is going to be needed to be covered from assets, well, a very simple, straightforward way of doing that is, you know, just for the sake of example, you need $100,000 a year. For 5 years, that's $500,000 that is going to be used in 5 years, then taking a bunch of investment risk with that $500,000 doesn't make a lot of sense. So CD is some other sort of principally protected asset that is still generating some sort of growth, whether it's a, you know, 1 to 3 year T-bill ETF, it's something like that, is a straightforward sleep at night way to reserve those funds, knowing, again, there's an end period. The funds are going to be used. So I think doing it that way is simple and straightforward. You put it in the email yourself, the big if market conditions remain relatively stable. And again, we have no way of predicting what market conditions are going to be in the next 5 years. They could be stable. They could be extremely volatile. And for that reason, we spouse that keeping that money principally protected, knowing again that it's going to be spent in this 5 year period, usually gives people some peace of mind to be able to go spend on fun during this period, knowing that their delay period is accounted for and safe and will be there for those food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses that they've quantified for that, in your case, 5 year period. So that's my kind of initial reaction to what this listener has written in. Mm-hmm.
Let me, for those who might be new listeners, even define what this delay period is we're talking about. So our approach really hinges on a couple key things. And one is this idea that we talked about earlier in the show of secure income covering your minimum dignity floor expenses, plus the appropriate amount of taxes. Throughout life. But we see people have kind of two phases in their life as far as needs for income. They've got the period once all their secure income is turned on, say Social Security, pensions, that from that point to death is all kind of stable. Their secure income has been triggered or turned on at that point. But there's a period prior to maybe turning on Social Security. This example, this person is waiting until 70 to do so, where because you don't have that income coming in, your expenses are not being satisfied by income. They're needing to be satisfied by assets. Because, though, the years before you turn on the Social Security, in my example, that's what we call the delay period. In those years, because there's a known end date, we don't propose that during those initial years of retirement that you fund those expenses with annuity income. Where we see annuities or other secure income really playing a pivotal role is in longevity protection. on the long end of your timeline, not the immediate needs that you have up front. So we cut essentially your retirement timeline into two pieces, two phases. The period before your secure income is turned on, where you're likely to be needing to make much larger distributions from assets, because why? You're in your go-go period and you don't have any income, or little income is turned on. And then secondarily, the post-delay period after the secure income is turned on, when for most people, their distribution needs are lower than, because they have secure income to satisfy at least a portion of their expenses. So that's, if you didn't know what we meant by delay period, that's what we're talking about. So he, by his own description, has an additional 5 years in his delay period. He's 65 now. He's going to turn on Social Security at 70. So he's going to satisfy his expenses, both minimum dignity floor and fund, both, with distributions from assets. Another key factor to consider in retirement that we haven't talked about is something called sequence of returns risk. So there's a couple reasons why we recommend people have a fair amount of principal protected assets available to them early in retirement. Principal protected assets are things like CDs, right? Can't go down in value. Value, minimum value is guaranteed by the institution, by the bank itself. Money market funds, which, except under really bizarre extreme examples, can't lose money directly. The principal is protected. Those types of things. Separated from market volatility, so obviously not susceptible to sequence of returns risk, which simply means the order in which you experience returns, both positive and negative, in retirement is critical for how it affects your overall assets over your retirement lifespan. Meaning that if you are unlucky enough to experience negative returns early in retirement, when you are also making these large distributions from the portfolio because you're in your delay period, that double whammy can be devastating for some people on their asset trajectories over time and really undermine what they're trying to accomplish in retirement, just because they were unlucky enough to either, you know, retire heading into, you know, a bear market or what have you, or some unforeseen events happen. It happens all the time, right? We get surprised by the markets behaving badly, if you will. So we and others, we're not the only ones, propose that you allocate your assets appropriately as you head into retirement. And in our view, it's for two reasons. One, there's a financial investment reason to do this, and that is to help protect against sequence of returns risk. So a true, I'll call it mathematical slash financial reason. But secondly, and I would argue just as importantly, what Jake pointed out, the emotional reason behind it. Even if the markets don't behave badly, if you're worried about how your retirement would look if they did behave badly, that's something that keeps people up at night and causes them to worry in retirement. So if they could visualize and actually see that they have X number of dollars, say for this person, the next 5 years of intended spending in dollars that are separated from the threat of sequence of returns risk, it does two things. It literally does protect against sequence of returns risk, and then it also gives people the peace of mind to be enjoying themselves during this critical go-go period of their retirement, which coincides with the delay period. So for him, he's asking, do I really need to have, and Jake, he didn't give us any numbers, the emailer, but you said, say, $100,000 a year. If you include the fund, the spending in the next 5 years might certainly be higher than that. Let's say $120,000 a year to cover minimum dignity floor and intended fund. Multiply that by five, we got $600,000 there. I would propose, if he has enough assets to support that level of spending, hopefully he does, that you launch into retirement with $600,000 worth of principal protected assets. That does not mean, though, year by year in those 5 years that you're going to take the money from there. If the markets are doing well, let's say instead of you have being unlucky with sequence returns, you're really lucky with sequence of returns, and your remaining assets that are invested, so other than the $600,000 that's in safety, is way up 20%, 25%, something like that. It's absolutely prudent to say, no, I'm going to take it from there instead.
Sure.
Take it out from there. Makes perfect sense to do that. So just because you set it aside to give you certain protections doesn't mean, I mean, if you've got some, you know, some armor hanging on the wall in your castle, it's nice to know it's there. You can put it on if something bad happens. But if something bad doesn't happen, it was still comforting to know it was there in case you needed it. It's kind of that idea. It's until you make it through the storm, make it past the period. Once you're past your delay period, you have your Social Security turned on, like in this case, the demand on your assets will be lower. The threat of sequence of returns risk has been lessened, maybe not gone all the way at the 5 or 6 year mark, but it's certainly declined. Your whole circumstances have changed, and your asset allocation needs are quite different at that point. And you probably don't need to have 6 years of spending in cash anymore. Some people do, right? Some people choose to do it that way. But it's really that critical early period where two things are happening. You're susceptible to sequence of returns risk, and you have heavy distributions from assets because you're delaying turning on your secure income, Social Security in this example. That's a double whammy. And the moat that you can build for yourself with principal protected, he's using CDs, is very, very valuable. Now, it doesn't have to be just CDs. There's other forms of principal protected assets that he could use. He doesn't have to be building it up specifically in CDs. That's just one example of principal protected assets. So he could consider some other things, but keep it simple. It's money that you need soon. It's not like it has time to do much for growth anyway. The critical factor here isn't eking out some return on the assets you're going to use in the next 5 years for spending. It's really protecting them. You've built what you've got. Those dollars, it's taken you maybe 30 years to grow. You're now in the last 5 years of them being in existence in your portfolio because you're about to spend them. It's not about growth potential now. It's about protecting what you've got and being able to sleep well at night and enjoy your retirement. That's the priority at that point. And principal protected assets just work so well to accomplish that, to include CDs, MIGAs, money market, stable value, you know, variety of things could fall into this category. So I think that's the way you look at it. It doesn't mean that because you've amassed this reserve that you're absolutely going to spend it all in the next 5 years. You might dynamically, depending on how things go, take it from the rest of your portfolio that's way up because things went really well. They weren't stable. They were very positive. But knowing that you could, in the case where markets are down and maybe down for several years, still happily spend from your CDs in this example, that's when you'll be thankful for sure that you built that reserve. Without it, could you arguably still safely spend 3% just because the portfolio's down? Probably could. But you're still exposing yourself to all the emotional trauma. That's the kicker. Just because you restrict your quote safe withdrawal rate to a really low number, you still don't avoid the natural human reaction to seeing your portfolio down 30 or 40%. People freak out. They already freak out from giving up their paycheck. They give up their paycheck and simultaneously the market takes, at least temporarily, 30 or 40% of their value. That's scary as heck for people. Mm-hmm. You can quiet that voice, that scary, you should be scared to death right now voice that's going to be yelling at you if you don't take steps to avoid it by simply building yourself this moat of principal protection to cover, in this person's case, the delay period in particular for the next 5 years, both minimum dignity floor and fund spending. We propose you protect both. These are expenses happening very soon. You don't have the risk capacity to be taking much risk with these assets in case the markets go down. If the markets just went up, we would never have to talk about any of this. You know, it'd be so easy. Yes, we might have an unknown return, but if markets are simply only going up, boy, people wouldn't be worried about the markets go down because they don't go down. That's obviously not realistic. The markets go down sometimes a little, sometimes a lot, sometimes for a short time, sometimes for a fairly long period of time. That's just what you get. That's the reality of the situation. So you need to take steps to protect from both the financial damage that could happen early in retirement by having the markets misbehave while you're taking out these large distributions. And secondly, quiet the voice that's going to tell you to be scared to death to be retired and spend money.
Right.
And I think, and we as a group pretty much agree, Jake, you can chime in. If not, I think you do, though, that having this principal protection pool accomplishes both.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Completely agree. Especially, and again, a lot of it's going to depend on the size of the portfolio, like I mentioned earlier. But for most people, yeah, taking a 30 to 40% drop, and then you're still going to be withdrawing from that when the assets are depressed, that is a tough pill to swallow. And by having this armor, this moat that Chris talked about through principal protection, allows you to leave those depressed assets alone, knowing that over time, we don't know how much time, but at least historically, eventually they're going to recover. And if you've got this other pool of assets that's at the ready to not have you have to change what you're doing in retirement, then we're big fans of that.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
Good question. Hopefully that was interesting. A little bit enlightening. So we're just pushing an hour here. So I know you and I both have some other stuff to go get to.
Yeah, fine.
So we'll probably wrap at this point. We have kind of a never-ending supply of these questions on our general process, what we think about certain aspects. In this case, they were kind of on their own doing some planning that was tied or at least consistent with our approach. So they were building their moat to handle the delay period. We have a lot of these, and we will periodically do these shows where we dig into this and talk about at least the way we view things. Not the only way of doing it. There's any number of, I always joke with my students that there's lots of paths to success, which is lucky for all of us, because if there was only one path and you had to find that one path out there in the woods, most of us would end up failing. Luckily, there's all kinds of paths to success, not only just generally in life, but in retirement too. There's a lot of ways to pull off a successful retirement. We have put a lot of effort, a lot of thought into our particular approach. Resonates with some people. Other people don't do it. People that don't follow our approach can certainly find still a path to successful retirement. So the way we describe it isn't the one and only way to do it. We certainly do share a few things on the show here that are absolutes, like the rules on, like the five-year rule with Roths. Right. Those are rules. Those aren't up for discussion. There's no path to an alternate rule. It's the rule is the rule. But a lot of what we talk about on here is kind of philosophy and approach and a nuance and kind of how we view things. And we appreciate that a number of you find that interesting and are trying to kind of replicate it on your own or embracing the concepts, because some of our thoughts are kind of out in left field a little bit compared to the mainstream. There's not a lot of planners who are doing it the way we do it. So long description of why I am not surprised we have a lot of questions about our approach. It's quite unique. Some of the stuff we say and the minimum dignity floor even is a creation of ours and you know, how we deal with that. And the fund number concept is fairly unique to what we do as well. So we appreciate everybody listening. And Jake, thanks again for being on here with me and sharing your insights.
Yep. My pleasure. And, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Everybody else, stay safe, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio. read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com, that's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com, or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.